Here's a sure bet. Ask anyone you know if they have strong feelings about their father, and the response will most likely be yes. Positive or negative or both. What about you? How has your father influenced your life? Welcome to Father Figures on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Cole Hornaday. Mind's Eye Radio is a program tuned to the sounds of social change. It is written and produced by The Writer's Place and Mind's Eye Audio Productions of Madison, Wisconsin. In this hour, the Mind's Eye writers explore the many roles that fathers play in our lives and how our relationship with our dads shape us, for both better or worse. Stay with us, won't you? Not too long ago, most men had a very clear idea of their role in the family. Work hard, bring home a paycheck, and reign as the authority figure. Women were seen as the caregivers and the ones that held the family together. In today's world, the role of both men and women have shifted. Many fathers are gladly taking a more active role in the rearing of their children and finding that nearly any time spent with a child is quality time. But Greg Willard, writer and father of three, reminds new and old fathers alike, don't push it.
I've got some bad news for those of us fathers, which is getting to be most of us fathers, who put in longer and longer hours at work away from our kids for shorter and shorter lived paychecks. The bad news? Quality time with your kids is a myth. Or to paraphrase the ads for the new Godzilla movie, duration matters. Now, this should come as no surprise for any father who, in the middle of a picture-perfect summer Sunday with the kids at the Vila Zoo, trips over or gags on one of those existential moments. Like, are we having fun yet? Is this it? Am I happy? Are my kids happy? Am I a good father? Am I really a father? Now, inevitably, the answer you give yourself is no, or a tepidly equivocal sort of, or maybe even a candy-colored you betcha. But even that kind of certainty can promptly melt under your gaze, like the oozing progress down your daughter's arm of her 3-scoop ice cream cone under the blazing Badger noonday sun. As you watch helplessly, her Michael's frozen custard turns to a vile, runny mustard, and your daughter screams that, "It's dripping on my jelly sandals! It's on my toes! Daddy, there's melted ice cream between my toes! Help me, Daddy! Now there's dirt stuck to the melted ice cream between my toes! Daddy, now there's ants! Daddy, you know the ants? They're trapped in the gummy ickiness, and it's starting to attract bumblebees! Help me!" Or even worse, "Why did you buy us the melting kind of ice cream?" Suddenly, your quality time with your kids is a custard of terror, from the pristine Kodak moment idea of fatherhood to rolls and rolls of under- or overdeveloped film that is, more often than not, the truest picture of our day-to-day lives with our kids. Of course, there are epiphanies, diamonds in the rough, quality times that jump out at you like highwaymen and just as suddenly hightail it back into the woods. So, you've had a miserable afternoon, your daughter devastated by the smacking adhesion of custard-coated feet to plastic sandals, swooning from sunburn, killer bees, the demise of the monkey house. But wait. Later that night, after the dust has settled, the ice cream cleaned off, the teeth brushed, she volunteers to tell you a goodnight story. The story of the monkey king who defends his house from the scientists who want to enslave them into organ grinders that grind the fruit and ice and cream and salt and sugar into monkey-made ice cream. Monkey's frozen custard. But the monkey king turns the tables on the scientists by unleashing a sea of melted ice cream that makes the scientists' shoes stick to the ground, just like my feet did today, so the monkeys can escape and find a new, safe house from science. The bad news is that quality time doesn't come on time. You can't schedule it, plan it, wait for it, or train the monkeys to grind it up on cue. Do that, and they'll just run away, leaving you with feet of clay or melted custard. This is Greg Willard with Mind's Eye Radio.
I can't get this baby to sleep. I've tried everything I know. I wish my dad were here.
Have you ever been in a difficult situation and just wanted a little fatherly advice? Well, Ron Cotell proudly announces the new Digital Audio Dad.
Oh, hey, wait. I've got my DAD right here.
This is your dad. Please state the crisis?
D.A.D., Jessica is driving me crazy. What's that bedtime story you used to tell me?
Don't panic, honey. Just hold me close to Jessica's ear. Once upon a time, there was an Easter egg named Fred who got lost in a shoe.
Yes, folks, a universe of advice and guidance at your fingertips, and a virtual shoulder to lean on when times get tough. All for the incredibly low price of just $19.99. Act now and get a DAD Advice for the Ages absolutely free. It contains such timeless classics as...
Son, you have to be the man of the family while I'm gone.
And... Young lady, I expect you to be home by 11 p.m. and not a minute later or you'll be grounded for life! As you've heard, our amazing digital audio dad comes in a variety of styles and accents, each so realistic you'll swear you're talking to the real thing. This is your dad.
Oh, thank God, digital audio dad. I just got a flat and I'm stuck here in the middle of nowhere. What should I do?
What are you doing driving alone on a deserted highway? You know how dangerous that is. You aren't going to visit that rock musician, are you? You know I don't approve of him. Oi, how I hate that! That's Digital Audio Dad, available now in all fine electronics stores. Get yours today.
Back in 1946, Dr. Benjamin Spock noted that the more research that went into child-rearing methods... the more they have come to the conclusion that what good mothers and fathers instinctively do for their babies is best after all. While this may be true, new father Mark Karstedt finds that instinct doesn't offer much comfort when faced with an ill child.
As a new father, I'm beginning to experience many aspects of life that I only observe passively or heard about secondhand. The best part of being a dad for me is receiving love from our child. The worst is watching our child endure sickness. What began as a runny nose prior to Halloween was a raspy cough and low-grade fever by Thanksgiving. We called family, friends, alternative traditional medical professionals, and visited the pediatrician several times trying to get to the bottom of it. 2 weeks before Christmas, we took her to the pediatrician. This time, he said, "I think it's developed into pneumonia." We were scared. Our little girl was really getting sick, and now from something which, not properly treated, could kill her. We immediately started her on antibiotics, the first batch she had received in 2.5 years. Her condition did not improve after the prescribed treatment. In fact, it worsened. Her pediatrician suggested we try a stronger medicine. The sick feeling in my stomach was a sign, and I should have listened. That afternoon, we gave her the first dose. After the second dose, she went to sleep, and we felt like maybe things were improving. After midnight, my wife had a mother's intuition experience and got out of bed to check on our little girl. As she walked into the room, our daughter coughed and proceeded to get sick atop her blankets. I sprang from bed, picked her up, and draped her over the side of the tub. This was the start of something. I knew it from the shaking of my knees. Within an hour, her little body was blistered and swollen, covered in red patches. We called a 24-hour health line, and they said, "Get your daughter to the closest emergency center immediately." We were terrified. Halfway down the deserted expressway, I remembered an acquaintance who died from an allergic reaction on the way to the hospital. I got even more scared at the thought of losing my little girl and was filled with a sense of guilt for not calling 911. At the hospital, the capable but tired staff and a dose of antihistamine calmed our fears. 14 days later, another infection surfaced in her stomach, brought on by the effects of the antibiotics. She needed another medication. Only this time, the medicine tasted awful. Even adults hate it, and she refused to swallow it. We tried explaining it to her and covering the taste with tens of mixtures without success. In our attempt to find an alternative, we called pharmacies, my sister a nurse, our brother-in-law a surgeon, playgroup parents, our parents, and 10 siblings. Per all our contacts, no other form of this medicine is available for kids. Eventually, we had to resort to pushing the pill down her throat. I had never heard of forcing a pill down a child's throat before and never thought I would have to resort to such barbaric methods. Our daughter is bright and caught on pretty fast that none of us like this method. It got to the point where she would take the medicine and hold it in her mouth with peanut butter and chocolate. Tears would stream down her face from the disgusting flavor, and she would look at us with sadness in her eye. Yeah, I know she had to take the medicine, but pushing a pill down her throat as she flails her limbs, screams, "Please, Daddy, don't," and bites my finger doesn't do much for self-validation. What it does do is remind me what being a father is all about. Being a father is caring for a child like you have cared for no other person. It's about teaching your child what they will need to learn to survive in the world. It's about trying to have the inner strength to set a good example and act in a manner that you want your child to emulate. It's about loving your child's mother so the child understands commitment, respect, and love. But mostly, being a father is having to do what needs to be done, like giving your child yucky medicine. The past few days, our daughter's health has improved, and that sick feeling in our stomachs that comes with observing our child endure sickness has passed. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Mark Karstedt.
Poet and songwriter Esther Cameron performs an original song called Devil's Train.
My father was an honest man. He rode the devil's train. At the window high, I saw him stand. I said, when will we meet again, dear man? When will we meet again? He said, dear girl, I do not know. Your way is long and hard. Remember that I loved you so. Remember who you are, my child. Remember who you are. And in a
Those who grow up with abusive fathers struggle throughout their lives with an idealized picture of how fathers are supposed to be. Poet Fran Zell found that it was only through poetry, and after her father died, that she could express her true feelings.
My father's funeral. 1. We bury my father on a mild April day. The rain holds off. My little nephews wear suits, dart in and out of big black limos in my brother's driveway. It is their first funeral. 2. A small group gathers at the gravesite, blood relatives under a makeshift canopy, others under an eggshell sky. There are 4 chairs. My brother directs me to the one next to my mother, knowing I won't protest. When the prayers begin, she reaches across all our bitterness and takes my hand. I don't let go. Like I cautioned the nephews playing in the limos, it's a funeral. 3. The cantor keens in that rich, melodic, minor key that connects all the mourners to all their dead, all their centuries. I hear wet breathing behind my back. The canter leans above the earthy hole where my father's casket sits, suspended. The soft tears fall in one ear now, then the other. I feel my mother's hand, light and papery as ashes. I know without turning, the nephews are crying. 4. The rabbi praises a man he never met. My brother fed him information, left out dad's rolling thunderheads, violent lightning, painted my father mild as the spring day on which we plant him. He becomes a man who loved his family in the proper way, was there when we needed him. He's not even the feeble grandfather my nephews cry for, bartering for love with stolen candy. The man whose tragic flaw followed him to senility. He refused to be aware of how he hurt people. The rabbi captured him well, my brother says, as we leave the cemetery. 5. We regroup at my brother's table, lunch on roast chicken, brisket, light eggy popovers made with matzah flour, because it is Passover, the festival of freedom. My mother leans across our cataclysmic silence, says she bought 2 graves yesterday, side by side. The second one's for me, she says, eyes opaque with meaning that passes over other heads. I will die before you, she adds, as if she still fears I'll race her to my father's bed. Thunder speaks in the western sky. A cousin supposes my father has made it up there. From a far-off room where little boys play, come screams of primal laughter.
That was poet Fran Zell. As Gay Davidson-Zilski watches her parents grow old, she relives vivid memories of her dad, although yesterday's memories are fading fast.
Shorty, the kids would sing out when someone puked in the lunchroom, and my dad would appear, sprinkling some gritty pickup stuff, and I would shrink. My dad, the janitor, scraper of Pleistocene gum from under chairs, driver of buses, replacer of fluorescents, rider of lawnmower, whistler, stoker of furnace before dawn. Shorty, the intercom would boom, and I would diminish, ashamed of his littleness of my own. Sometimes, as I played at recess or gazed daydreaming out the wide, accusing eyes of windows, my mother walked by. Also small, she wore my daddy's T-shirts, overalls, and broad canvas sneakers before any of this could pass for normal. Sometimes, lonely from housework, she would pause, look longingly where we were all caged. Mrs. Shorty, the kids would call, and I would try to vanish. Yesterday, I delivered them home to their shrunken apartment, one cell in a hive of elders who still housekeep, some barely. All week, I had driven my father and mother, trying to amaze them with my grown-up goodness, but terrified that I would let them break. My mother's fragile heart, my father's rice paper skin, once a map of interstates, now a different colored map of veins that bloody at the touch. Their lives more circumscribed as mine expands. Their newsreel pans from woolly backwoods Arkansas to farm to tenant farm to town to village to pride of self-built home to this window they will never own. I videotaped them, Mr. and Mrs. Shorty, waving from the frame of their third floor, sillless window, fading, then forced myself to drive away. Their shocks of cotton hair, their beaming love, their littleness lingering as I watched in my rear view. These objects farther away than they appeared. This is Gay Davidson-Zelski for Mind's Eye Radio.
As a child ages, especially a son, he begins to relive the life he watched his father struggle through. Writer Dick Radke invites us to listen in on a conversation between a father and his son, long after the father's been buried.
After the divorce hearing, Galen found refuge at the wheel of his 10-year-old Audi and drove south to the cemetery where his father lay buried. He parked at the gate and searched 10 long minutes among the headstones before coming upon Walter, leaning against a marble obelisk in section J8.
Hello, Boomer. About time you came to see your old man.
First time I've been here in, what, 12 years? You're not an easy person to find.
Been here all along. Haven't gone anywhere since they put me in this hole. Seems a lifetime ago. That's cemetery humor, Galen.
Shelley divorced me today.
Happens all the time. Your mother divorced me when you were 5 years old.
That was different. You saw it coming.
Nobody sees it coming, son. Man can't see a train wreck about to happen. With me, it was drink. What was it with you?
What's wrong with you? You sound terrible.
Head cold. Cemetery's a terrible place for head colds. Got it up here, got it down here. And no running to the drugstore for those new miracle drugs. Now, what about you? What was it that puts you on the outs?
Been trying to figure that out. We hardly ever argued. It was more like a chill came over her, as if icicles were forming on her heart. Then she found Freddy. No fights, just Freddy.
Remember the Friday night fights, Boomer? Joe Louis? Remember the brown bomber?
On the radio.
He was a fighter, Joe Louis was.
I remember the ring announcer, the crackle in the airwaves. I believed I could get a shock just touching the radio. We sat in front of the Crosley with the lights dimmed, you smoking your old golds. You'd clench your fists and rock forward in that old mohair chair, looking like a fighter yourself.
Hell of a fighter, Joe Louis. Better than Dempsey, better than Tunney. Wouldn't be beaten. After the fight, he'd always say, Mama, I'm okay.
I should be going.
Where to?
Yeah, where? Not as if I had a real home anymore.
Now you know what it was like for me.
You'd take me down to the switchyard to watch the trains, then over to Nubbs Tavern for a few quick ones.
I was known in old Nubbs' place.
On the way home, you'd tell me to wipe the cherry soda from my mouth and keep quiet if Mom asked about the tavern. She always did. I always confessed. And you always gave me that look of betrayal.
You could never dummy up.
As if I was the one who'd put you in the doghouse.
Now smoke swirled around Walter's head, as if the magician in him would whisk him away at any second, leaving his audience wondering what had happened. Wondering how he managed to make not only the volunteer from the audience disappear, but the magic box and the magician himself.
You did card tricks on the dining room table, pulled out the ace of spades before my eyes, flipped a lighted cigarette back inside your mouth without burning your tongue, then flipped it back out again, still lit.
I was a wizard.
You knew how to blow smoke rings with a cigarette and claimed that you'd make them perfectly round if I'd buy you a cigar.
You begged me to let you try, like the man in the camel's billboard did, every 15 seconds. When I let you try, it got me into the doghouse with your mother.
You built your own doghouses. For a long time, you vanished into thin air. Then one day, you came walking down the sidewalk as though you'd never left, and asked me if I didn't remember my old man.
I'd been in the lockup. She put me there for not paying support.
Shelley's left me. She left me for my friend, Freddy. Was I such a bad husband?
You're asking the wrong person. Remember, I was the original bad apple.
Yes, yes you were. You poisoned yourself one dime beer at a time. The last time I saw you was in the indigent ward of the county hospital. Tubes in your nose.
You asked how I was, but one look should have told you. I remember that damn horse-faced nurse coming down the hall with her sensible shoes clattering like gunshots on those marble floors. After that, it's all a blank.
I remember you said you were really in the doghouse this time, in the doghouse for good. Then you closed your eyes and slipped away.
Leaving that nurse and all the women who'd ever judged me behind.
The light faded over the gravestones, and a cold breeze swept through the trees. Galen rose and turned, and when he looked back, his father had vanished. He'd always been good at that, the magician who made aces appear and disappear. Over the fence in the neighborhood, a dog howled. Galen headed for his car and the drive home.
What if you bumped into your father as a complete stranger? How would he appear? Sharon Van Sluis wonders in her poem, To My Father, Who Does Not Speak Easily.
I would like to meet you someday as a stranger. I would like to accidentally step in your path as you stroll around some hardware store searching for the right bolt, the special finishing nails, easing past the new shipment of skill saws, touching the stoneware for the ladies briefly, thinking of your wife's chipped soup bowls. I would nonchalantly stop you and inquire, what would be the best method, the suitable materials, which tools would serve me well enough? And although you would also be only a customer, you would describe to me which route to follow, the hazards to avoid. As it is, I see you briefly through my own resemblances. My voice is quiet, gravelly as yours. My hair glints with the red in your hidden beard. My hands will carry your bent index fingers into the next generation. You are splintered before me like an old mirror. Some pieces reflect to me my eyes, the bridge of my nose, the arrangement of my teeth. Some are turned silver side down, and I am drawn to what is not shown me. I am drawn to what you become alone. Someday I will round a corner somewhere and see you whole before me unawares.
Sharon Van Sluis's book of poetry is titled Under the Influence of Blackbirds. Not since the 1950s and 60s have people supported the media myth that father knows best. In fact, some fathers are emotionally abusive to their children, even if unintentionally. Jackie Wilson tells of a fictional account based on a true experience of a 10-year-old who brought home a D in math.
That night after supper, her father called her into the living room and sat her down on the couch beside him. Rowena eyed him with trepidation, trying to push back the sudden winds of terror that were springing up all around her. He doesn't look so upset. I'll try really hard and I'll do it and everything will be okay. All right now, Rowena, we're going to do some problems from last month that I know you've already had, so they'll be easy ones, and then we'll do some of the ones you're having trouble with. Rowena felt it best not to point out that she had trouble with all math problems. Math had always been her weakest subject. It was as hard for her intellectually as socializing was emotionally. She couldn't fathom why. After all, her father and sister both excelled in math, so there was no reason for her not to do the same, but for all that, she couldn't get it through her head. She did pretty well in English. Well, no big trick there, since it was so easy. But math was always just beyond her. She fought back a sense that had begun growing in her like a cancer, that she just didn't try hard enough when it came to anything even the least bit difficult. Okay, look here. This is division. Now, if we divide 2,000 by 25, what do we get? Rowena thought. She knew the answer. They'd had that last quarter. But her mind was suddenly blank. Seeing her father's expression change from expectancy to anger, it's 10. No, damn it, no. You can't just guess, Rowena. You've got to know. And I know that you've had this and you do know it, so quit fooling around. You've got to do the problem, not just say anything. Now try it again. Here, you write it down and then work it out on paper. Rowena took the pencil and paper, trying to control her shaking enough to write. She copied the problem, desperately hoping the answer would come to her by the time she finished, but all that stared back at her was the problem in the paper. She felt as if she were drowning in a sea of black and white. Well, what's the answer? Come on now, you've had more than enough time. The anchor of her father's voice shot through her and came out her feet, pulling her to the bottom. I don't know, Daddy, said a small voice that sounded a lot like hers. Avery exploded. Damn it, Rowena, don't give me that. Yes, you do know. You're perfectly capable of doing it. This is exactly why you're having trouble, because you won't even try. You work it out and come out with the right answer this very minute, young lady, or by God, I'll put you over my knee and teach you to do it that way. Rowena burst into tears, too terrified to do anything else. I shouldn't. It will only make him madder. But the thought was a tinker toy log shoring up a huge dam that burst, sweeping everything away along with it. She felt the pain as her father grabbed her and started spanking her on the butt. She sobbed uncontrollably for a timeless time until he finally jerked her upright onto the sofa. "Dry it up! Dry it up!" "Please, Daddy, please, I can't help it," begged Rowena. "Oh, God, I've got to make him see. I've got to, if I can just make him see." "Yes, you can help it. How the hell do you expect to learn this if you won't even try? Now dry it up and do this, and this time it better be right." He shoved the paper under her nose and the pencil into her hand. Rowena looked helplessly at the paper, then back at her father, then dissolved again into terrified sobs. Avery glared at her. What was wrong with this kid, anyway? Why wasn't she even trying to put any effort into this, especially with him making every effort to be patient and helpful? With all the trouble he was going to, his daughter could at least try instead of spending all her time feeling sorry for herself. "Doris! Doris, get in here, damn it!" he hollered at the kitchen. His wife came through the door. "Yes, dear, what's wrong?" "What the hell do you think is wrong? I'm trying to help Rowena with her math, and she won't do it. She won't even try. Why don't you get the hell in here and help me?" "Now, dear, I'm sure it's not all that serious. Maybe it would be best if you just let it go over tonight and started fresh tomorrow night. I think you've done enough for one night." "What do you mean we've done enough? We haven't done anything. Christ, our daughter brings home a D in math and you say it's not serious? You're a big help." "Well, dear, I think maybe you're just tired. That's making it worse. I know you had a really hard day today and Rowena's probably a little tired too, so it would be best all around if everybody got a good night's sleep and tried again tomorrow. I'm sure that's the whole trouble right there, that you're both just tired. Rowena, come on, it's time for bed. Honey, you just sit right there and watch your favorite program and you'll feel much better tomorrow. Rowena will, too, and then she'll be able to do these math problems with no trouble and everything will be fine." Rowena went upstairs, cold and numb in body and mind. She was glad for the reprieve, even though it was only temporary. Every night for the next 3 months, Avery sat Rowena down on the couch and started going over math problems. Every night was pretty much the same. Avery expecting Rowena to know it this time, Rowena failing to know it this time, Rowena terrified and crying, Avery yelling and usually spanking, and nothing much being accomplished in the math department. Avery simply couldn't understand it. He was busting his butt to help his daughter, even giving up some of his favorite TV programs to give her the extra attention he knew he never would have gotten from his parents. So why wasn't she learning and making progress instead of sitting and crying? Rowena's next report card registered a C in math. Not a lot of improvement, as her father put it, but enough to get her out of the forbidden zone and stop the nightly torture sessions. She was eternally grateful for that, but she couldn't shake a vague, undefined feeling of walls that were closing in on her that always miraculously stopped just short of crushing her to death. Deep within her, a low-grade, chronic fear was developing, like an emotional fever, that the walls would someday start closing in, and this time, not stop.
That was writer Jackie Wilson reading from her novel, Square Peg Life. You're listening to Father Figures on Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up, a feminist and her father, and a daughter's endearing memories of her father. Stay with us.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not in temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
This is Paul Thompson. For 2,000 years, Christians have prayed to Our Father, who art in heaven. Today, many theologians question this masculine image of the Supreme Being. I was curious how the Sunday school students I help teach feel about this. They are a group of bright and inquisitive 6th 7th and 8th graders. Here are some fragments of our discussion.
When I look at God, I usually just, I see Jesus like what you see in books or what you see when you watch Jesus Christ Superstar. That's what I see when I'm thinking of God.
Like if you buy a book here in the U.S., you'll see that Jesus is supposedly white. But then you go to Africa and you see a different book and the pictures of Jesus are more tannish, creamish. He's more like, he looks like a half black, half white kind of person.
Katie, how do you think of God?
Well, I picture God as what he looks like in books.
You see God as a man then?
Yeah.
Does everybody here see God as a man?
Yeah. I don't really see God. I don't see anything. I just think of it as somebody to talk to and somebody to think things through with.
Some ministers these days speak of God as mother and speak of God as a she. How do you feel about that, Stephanie?
We don't really know. I mean, there's no problem with it. I mean, you can't say it's wrong, but you can't say it's right.
Well, you don't really know if Jesus is a woman or man, because he could be either, because everybody thinks alike, but maybe they have different visions and different thoughts.
We do have one source of proof, which is Jesus, whom has been on this earth and has been seen. We do know that Jesus was a man, and since he called God a word that meant Father, I think it would make more sense if he was a man, now that I know that piece of information.
Because Mary, when she had Jesus, because they said that there was the Son of God, so it just kind of makes sense because Mary was the mother, so then you know that God had to be a man.
Isn't it a possibility, since that was actually supposed to be the Holy Spirit, that Jesus is male, the Holy Spirit is male, then God is female, possibly.
Okay, what do you think would have happened if instead of Jesus being a male, if he had appeared in ancient Palestine and had been a female? How would the message have been received?
Back then, people didn't pay that much. They didn't pay attention to women, though, because men were in dominant power. And even nowadays, they still have that, oh, women you don't take as seriously, depending on like where you are or what you're doing. But even back then, definitely, and still in Africa, they don't have, women don't dominate at all. Men, they let men do the speaking and things like this. So they wouldn't have taken the woman seriously.
My mom, when she's praying, she usually says Creator instead of Father, because there's no real way to know. But it's mostly accepted that God is a father, a man.
I think that really God's somewhat above classification as male or female. I think that God is more powerful and has risen above that.
I think that maybe if Jesus had come as a woman, that it's possible that what Nalu said would have happened, that he would have been just discarded, thrown off. Either that or what might have happened was the females might have taken a bigger role in the history.
Katie, do you think that we might even look at God as being a brother or a sister?
Yes, because you can count on God to be there for you. Like if I tell one of my friends one of my problems, it will be around the school by noon. And I just tell him all my problems.
I had just noticed that everybody has been still calling God he, which still shows that we still sort of think of God as male. Just that I found that interesting.
On behalf of Mind's Eye Radio, this is Paul Thompson thanking Grace Episcopal Church in Madison, Wisconsin, my fellow Sunday school teacher Donna Mackey, and most of all, the students who took part in this discussion, Katie Berberet, Willie Horney, Stephanie Jashonik, Nalu Mukasa, Matthew Pollack, Stacy Saunders, and Kyle Work.
Perhaps, not surprisingly, a daughter's favorite and most influential memory of her father stems from innocent moments in her childhood. Jennifer Cheverini remembers her dad making trails.
Like most of the men in the Michigan neighborhood where I grew up, my father loved a green lawn. To him, dandelions were a scourge, crabgrass a blight, the guy from the local garden center, a prophet. My father lavished care on that lawn as if it were his fourth child. That's why he was the last person you'd expect to invent the game my sister and I called Making Trails. It all started one summer afternoon when I was 6. My father was mowing the lawn while my sister Heather and I played nearby. We were certain he'd mow over us if we didn't stay out of the way, so we played on only that part of the lawn that had already been cut. Eventually, we decided that the best place of all was right behind him. It was like follow the leader, with my dad in front pushing the lawnmower. Back and forth we'd go, first in one direction straight across the yard, then a turn, and then back the other way, the roar of the motor in our ears, the smell of fresh-cut grass and gasoline in the air. Then one day, the unimaginable happened. Just as we were completing our fifth pass across the yard, my dad suddenly veered to the left and headed off at an angle. My sister and I were shocked. What was he doing? Everyone knew you were supposed to keep the lawnmower wheels in the impression left behind on the previous pass. But here was my dad, keeper of the lawn, expert grass cutter, going the wrong way. First he made a diagonal line, and then a zigzag, and then a curve. My dad was all over the place, drawing squiggles and scribbles on his green canvas, creating a maze with the lawnmower. His face gave nothing away, as if everyone mowed the lawn that way. So Heather and I followed along, pretending that he hadn't lost his mind. It didn't take us long to realize that these new patterns were much better than boring old straight lines. After that, the game evolved. Whenever my dad announced that he was going to mow the lawn, my sister and I would beg, "Can you make trails?" Most of the time, he'd agree, and he would cut paths all over the yard in broad meanders, zigzags, and spirals. My sister and I would play in the trails as he went to the far side of the yard and began mowing in the old-fashioned way, straight across. Bit by bit, the trails would disappear until the whole yard was finished. But while the trails remained, we had the best playground on the block. Still, our lawn never again had that crisp perfection of the neighbor's yards, which could have been the Rose Bowl turf in comparison. And looking back, I now realize making trails must have added a good half hour to my dad's mowing job. But I don't remember him ever complaining about the time spent or the neatness lost. For years we played making trails until the games faded into the past with the rest of childhood. Eventually my father passed on the lawn mowing chores to my older brother. Later we moved to California, to a neighborhood of houses on small lots separated by high fences. The lawns were so small you could trim them with hand clippers. The time for making trails was over. Many years later, I was shopping for a card for my dad when I found one that seemed made especially for him. On the front were three pictures of Snoopy pushing a lawnmower back and forth. Opening the card revealed that he had cut the words, "Happy Father's Day," into the cartoon lawn. I bought the card, and when I gave it to my dad, tears came into his eyes. "I'd forgotten all about that game," he said, with a look that thanked me for reminding him. I think he underestimated the importance of the games we played, and the way he taught me that being a good parent means allowing for the zigzags and squiggles of life. I wonder if he had any idea how many trails he set me upon, both in the backyard and elsewhere. I wonder if, like me, he now realizes he was a better father than either of us knew. This is Jennifer Cheverini for Mind's Eye Radio.
Jennifer Cheverini's first novel, The Quilter's Apprentice, will be published in April. Writer Tacy Rozalowski had a similar experience, a secret, playful bond she built with her father that stayed with her through the years. She recounts it in her essay, The Juice of Words.
When I was in junior high, my father and I became partners in a rebellion. My mother had put us on diets to rein in my adolescent bloom and my father's middle-aged spread. As the calorie counts, surveillance, and guilt grew, so did our pangs of privation. My father and I became masters of food crime. We sneaked to the kitchen for slabs of rye bread and handfuls of cereal after my mother went to bed. We wolfed down secret hot dogs on the way home from the library. My father and I never openly acknowledged our plots. We'd just wink any time my mother disappeared into the basement to fold clothes. I embraced our secret body language. We never had a talking relationship, never shared high emotion in any other situation. So a finger pointing to a comically gaping mouth measured a secret, treasured bond. I indulged with my father even when I didn't want to eat another bite, just to feed my appetite for our growing ritualistic bond. Ordinarily, our crimes demanded speed and daring. But on Wednesday nights, my mother sometimes went ice skating. Then my father and I indulged our appetite with leisure and luxury. That's when I discovered that my father loves pomegranates. It's an odd exotic fruit, fist-sized, a mottled red, without any real flesh. The tough skin holds hundreds of large seeds, each surrounded by a red pulp, a scarlet, sweet-sour treat. So I learned one Wednesday when my mother went ice dancing. My father and I zoomed to the grocery store, speeding to the produce section on a surgical strike mission for a single perfect pomegranate. Back home again, my father told me to grab a kitchen stool. He went for the cutting board and selected his knife. We convened by the stainless steel sink. He laid out our implements, with me perched next to him on that precarious stool. Years later, I'd learned the French word, frisson, to describe the shiver of nervous excitement that ran through me as my father stood a little taller and his gestures became a little theatrical. He took the knife in one hand, the pomegranate in the other. Then he raised them high in front of us and made his announcement in a deep voice. We were going to perform a human sacrifice. "Human sacrifice," he said, as if a funny voice and fractured pronunciation would somehow cover up what we were pretending to do. "The first cut." He scored around the middle of the pomegranate. "Now the second cut." I watched the knife divide the skin into quarters. When the cuts began to ooze, my father raised an eyebrow meaningfully, then held up the fruit. Just briefly, as we watched the juices splash scarlet onto the wooden board, I felt disgusted by what we were doing. My excitement pushed the feeling away. Then my father set down the fruit and hacked it into quarters. "This is the liver," he said, handing me a segment. He took the heart for himself. We crammed the fruit into our mouths, crunching down on the seeds and grunting. "We're barbarians," my father mumbled through his hunk of pomegranate. I looked into his eyes and nodded. The juice dripped and turned our chins and hands ruby red. We growled and chewed and rolled the seeds around in our mouths until the pulp was extracted, the juice swallowed. Then we spat out the seeds. We spat them hard so they landed, kerthwang, in the stainless steel sink. We aimed each blast of seeds against my mother's diet police state, but that's only part of the reason why our barbarian act gave me such delight. It seemed to transport me somewhere beyond the family and outside of ordinary time. During our ritual, my depressive, unparticipating father revealed a rare flash of joy and a quirky capacity for play. That magical transformation infected me, too. It came to me suddenly and with a touch of fear as I leaned over the sink to watch the red juice swirl down the drain. And I knew, just as surely as I knew that the stains splashed on my sweatshirt would never wash out, I knew that the pomegranate juice had turned to human blood. We had said it. It was so. As a kid, I saw old photographs of my father. He was thin, dark-haired and pale, a little vulnerable-looking, staring wide-eyed over his altar boy lace. A child of Polish immigrants, my father was raised Catholic. Somewhere on the path to adulthood, he gave up his religion. But perhaps his childhood memory retained the knowledge that the pomegranate is a potent Catholic symbol of the one and the many. This symbolism may have added its own flavor to my father's taste for the fruit. I was unaware of such connotations. My mother and father had decided to raise me Unitarian. So I also couldn't know that my father's childhood religion reached out and shaped that fanciful ritual, the game of barbarian transubstantiation that an ex-Catholic played with his Unitarian daughter in a suburban kitchen. On this strange path, the pomegranate came to me. Secular and domestic, poetic and pagan, the pomegranate passed through my father's life and through his hands so he might feed me the material power of words. This is Tacy Rozalowski for Mind's Eye Radio.
Two men, one cut from the other's cloth, can stand at arm's length, say little, and never quite have the nerve to break the stubborn silence. Here, Gaither Valtzen says a prayer for his father.
It would be just you and I, an afternoon of fishing, Maine woods, Churchill Stream, 30 years before all these crude decisions we'd made about each other. The day would be early, cool, pant legs damp with dew, shards of sunlight piercing stands of birch and willow, blue jays' raucous cries echoing from empty spaces. We wade downstream, thigh deep, you leading, tossing delicately measured cast of silver and red spinners, skirting overhangs slipping like secrets into trout-laden pools. On this day, the big ones, the ones that before always got away, explode like Russian dancers from the depths, hook in mouth, as if celebrating the end of their somnolent deception. Yet we will not react. Instead, allow our monofilament to roll like silk web off tingling fingertips. Give our counterparts time to run, hide, save face, get used to the idea of being hooked. Only when the trout turns sluggish do we pull home, reel clicking steadily, pole held firm yet always yielding to the subtle and vulnerable nature of our prey. Our fish, not so stubborn as us, will arrive in sun, sheening so bright off silvery scales, our eyes will blink, then water, and for a second we both turn away, embarrassed. For it will be a shock to have caught what we always desired, to share a time when we both win and not lose. We will ease out the barbed hook, offer the prize skyward like a newborn, laugh, clap each other on the back, release it to the river, alive, honored, like forgiveness. Afterwards, we sit together on the sandy bank, silent and listening, drink thermos coffee, eat ham sandwiches, while the day recedes and the dusk descends like strong thoughts. We will leave, sated, a boy's migratory flight finally over, well blessed by his father's pool, now rippling with love. Both men no longer doubting, it is the same river from which we flow. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Scary dreams can send kids running to their parents' bed in search of comfort and reassurance. Pat Dijak remembers a time when she awoke under the protective wing of a mother bird.
When I was 4 years old, I dreamt that my father had filled the dining room with taxidermied animals, deer, raccoons, and bears. My little sister and I were crawling around the animals as if we were in a forest when, suddenly, a bear standing on its hind legs came alive and gobbled up my sister, flannel booties and all. I was terrified and ran up the stairs to the second floor, but that bear was right behind me, chewing on my leg by the time I reached the landing. I woke up and ran to my parents' room. They had a queen-size bed, which they just about filled. However, if they both turned to face their respective outside edges, then there was a lovely, safe tent in between them. I slipped into this sanctuary and fell asleep. When we woke up the next morning, I had curled up next to my dad's side, under his arm. He said to me, "I dreamt last night that I was a mother bird, and I woke to find a baby bird underneath my wing." Now, this story may explain a lot about my love of bird figurines and my antipathy to stuffed animals, but it is, most of all, a memory that sustains me in troubled times. I have degrees and publications that I'm proud of. I have wonderful friends who let me cry on their shoulders and whom I celebrate with. I have a fairly decent relationship with my folks, but it's this mother bird memory that I find most sustaining. I'm not sure why. Perhaps it's because we needed so few words, because I knew there'd be a space for me, nestled close to my father. Perhaps it's because such complete acceptance couldn't have happened at any other time in our lives, under any other circumstances. Whatever the reason, I know for certain if I can hold on to this moment of unguarded love, then I can survive anything the world throws at me and fly strong. This is Pat Dijak with The Writer's Place and Mind's Eye Radio.
And finally, Karen Schultz with a tribute to her father, whose values she respects and upholds as she creates a path of her own.
I became a feminist when I became a flight attendant. Prior to this time, I was just a young woman who thought the world believed she could be and become anything. I was raised by two people who thought this, my mom and dad. My dad especially believed in my mind and my ability to create ideas. To this day, my dad and I communicate like social scientists. Both of my parents taught me the value of choice, but Dad, in particular, warned me about the stupidity of making choices based on society's pressures. He used to say, if you compare yourself to crap, you turn into crap. Perhaps this came from his experience as a child in Poland during the Second World War. There wasn't much time for him to worry about social pressures when survival was at hand. But somehow, I think his personal passion and direction was even deeper than that. He never believed he was a victim to anything, particularly society. He believed he had choices, and he believed I did too. Who I was had nothing to do with my gender. It had to do with who I chose to be as a person. When I became a flight attendant, you can imagine my surprise when the people surrounding me believed I was limited to my gender and the stereotypes that went with it. They thought I was nurturing when I was not. Passengers would ask male flight attendants for solutions to their flight problems and help in lifting their bags. They reserved their personal problems for the female flight attendants. And I really didn't care if they didn't bring toys for their children on a 5-hour flight. All I could think of was why they didn't have the personal responsibility to take care of the problems themselves. When I would get into a conversation with a male passenger, I would often get a business card indicating that conversation meant flirtation, not intellectual discussion. And once, when I was reading Chaos, a book on a theory of physics, a pilot asked me why I was reading it. I told him I was interested in the topic. When he asked me again, I told him the theory could impact our lives. After the third time, I realized he meant, why was I, a dumb flight attendant, reading this book? After my first year of flying, I spent the next in sheer rage. It was painful growing out of naivete. I couldn't understand the sexism I was faced with, not to mention the racism I found out about, too. At the time, I don't think my dad understood why I became a feminist. What he knew of feminists was that they didn't seem to like men. What he didn't realize was that for most of us, becoming a feminist is about celebrating ourselves. My relationship with him was, in fact, the impetus for my expectations for good relationships with other men. My dad also taught me to be intolerant of men and women who could not appreciate the unlimited possibilities for all people. In fact, he used to say, if they don't like it, screw them. Perhaps if I had these words back then, my dad would have understood much more readily. He certainly understood the idea of standing up for yourself. Most people faced with difficulties seem to end up as proactivists or victims. My dad is a proactivist with very little time for self-pity. Just as I have chosen to funnel my concerns into political action, so has he. When corporate America downsized him because of his age, my dad fought back, started up his own business, and became a vocal citizen. He made the choice to prevail with dignity. Today, I enjoy an incredible adult relationship with my father. We spur each other on. He loves to play devil's advocate in discussions, as he did when I was a child, to get me to say what I mean, to make me show the fighter he knows I am. When we disagree, and it gets heated, his eyes light up, and sometimes he smiles. In this, my dad reveals how much he believes in me, how much he loves the strong woman I am. What an incredible gift to give a child, to give a daughter. This is Karen Schultz for Mind's Eye Radio.
You've been listening to Father Figures on Mind's Eye Radio. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Sue Renard, with audio production assistance by Sharon Van Sluis. The show was written by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. Writers include Esther Camera, Jennifer Cheverini, Gay Davidson-Zilski, Pat Dijak, Mark Karstedt, Dick Radke, Sue Renard, Tacy Rosolowski, Karen Schultz, Sharon Van Sluis, Paul Thompson, Guyther Valdson, Greg Willard, Jackie Wilson, and Fran Zell. The Mind's Eye players include Sue Renard, Dick Radke, Paul Schultz, and me, Cole Hornaday. Original music by Barbara Chusett. I'm Cole Hornaday, inheritor of my father's bold tone and fragile frame.